supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. You know, every day in my office, I deal with people who are ashamed of their own vulnerabilities or their perceived inadequacies. I keep hearing the question, am I normal? Is that normal? They live in fear that if they were ever known for who they are, their fragilities and problems, they'll be unloved, they'll be rejected. And I would argue that that's not just people in my office. That's a human anxiety. We have this need to be known for who we are, and we have this fear of being known for who we are. The recent death of CBS reporter Mike Wallace reminds us of his own courageous stand of talking about what was most vulnerable to him, his experience with severe depression, and as he said, when his life was spinning out of control. On today's show, we'll talk about our relationship with our own vulnerability and how it can lead us to shame and withdrawal, or it can take us to self-acceptance, self-compassion, and a genuine intimacy with others. My first guest is Brené Brown. She's a research professor at the University of Houston Graduate College of Social Work. She spent many years studying vulnerability, courage, worthiness, shame, and empathy. She now uses that work to explore a concept that she calls wholeheartedness. Here she is in a TED Talk called Listening to Shame.
Vulnerability is not weakness. I define vulnerability as emotional risk, exposure, uncertainty. It fuels our daily lives. And I have come to the belief, this is my 12th year doing this research, that vulnerability is our most accurate measurement of courage.
Brené Brown, welcome to Voices in the Family.
I'm so happy to be with y'all today. Thank you.
Thanks. And of course, if you want to join our conversation, our number is 888-477-9499. We'd love to hear from you. How do you feel about your own vulnerability, that which you are uncomfortable with, uncomfortable talking about and having others to know? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. So, I've been thinking, Brené, about why it's so universal to be afraid of our own vulnerability, and I thought about, our evolutionary genes. Animals, when they're vulnerable, get killed.
No, I think that's absolutely right, and I think even dropping maybe further down, I think the bottom line, at least what I've found in my research, is that we are absolutely hardwired for connection. Neurobiologically, cognitively, hardwired to be in connection. And so I think what happens is the fear of disconnection, which is another way that I think about shame, the fear that someone's going to find out something about us, something that we've done or failed to do, even something that happened to us that was out of our control. Someone's going to learn something about us that makes us unworthy of that connection that we so biologically, emotionally need. And so, and if we draw, if we think back in time in terms of evolutionary biology, exactly what you said is true. You lead the dinosaur back to the cave, the dinosaur finds and eats my family. How are you dealt with by the community? You're shunned or shamed, which means you're physically separated from the group, which ensures your death. And so there's a long biological evolutionary component, I think, to vulnerability and shame. The problem is that as we've evolved, and as our capacity for understanding emotion in ourselves and other people has evolved. Shame is becomes far too blunt of an instrument to be helpful. And the protection, the way we hide and protect our vulnerabilities rather than protecting us, keeps us from being known. It keeps us from the very thing that we're seeking, which is connection.
What makes that so universal, that fear of being known? I mean, that seems a very human dialectic, that what I said in the introduction, that hunger to be known and that fear of being known.
Isn't it just the most complex paradox? I mean, it's just, you know, we're as desperate to have people see us as we are to hide from people. It's really the heart of my work.
It's like almost like a divine sense of humor, you know? Here, deal with that.
No, it's true. And I think it goes back to this need for connection. And I would argue that love and belonging are irreducible needs of men, women, and children. And that in the absence of love and belonging, there is always suffering. And so the irony, the humor that, you know, we're talking about here is that in order to fully experience love and belonging, we have to be seen and known.
I would suggest, and I say this often, I'm curious about your reaction. It's my belief, Brené, that the hunger to be known exceeds the hunger even to be loved. Because when someone tells us they love us, there's always that secret, that response, that internal response. Yeah, they say they love me, but if they only knew.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems to me that being known is even more important than being loved.
That's a really interesting argument. I would probably say, depending on, you know, one of the things I do in my work is I try to define. I'm a qualitative researcher, so I try to use the experiences, the language, the stories of my research participants to write definitions and to craft definitions of things like love. So I think it depends on how we're defining love. I mean, I think...
Oy vey.
Yeah, I think maybe letting ourselves be seen and really being seen may be a prerequisite for the most fundamental, purest part of love.
Hmm.
I think what we all have a tendency to do, myself included, is try to figure out, if I want you to love me, I try to figure out what it is that I need to do to deserve that love. And I perform and I please and I prove and I become what I think I want you, what I think you want me to be. And it sets up a real house of cards, I think, in our relationships, because, you know, we can only sustain that for so long. You know, and I think that's what drives shame. I think that's what drives probably, you know, what psychologists and sociologists call the master emotion, you know, this whole idea of shame or the fear of being found out.
So when we work so hard to become the people we think we should be, then we're disconnected from the people we are. We never get to know
right. That
person or become that person. But my God, Brené, it's so easy to work towards being the person we think we should be.
Oh, I'm so good at it. I get like a gold star.
Really?
Oh, yeah, because I study people and vulnerability for a living, so I don't have to know someone for very long to figure out exactly. I mean, I think most of us, I don't think you have to be a vulnerability researcher to have the skill set of assessing and acclimating.
You know,
one of the things that you may find very interesting is that when I was studying the concept of belonging, guess what emerged as the number one barrier to belonging?
Vulnerability.
It was actually fitting in.
Fitting in. Oh, right, of course. Fitting in is a barrier to belonging, right.
which just completely kind of sucked for me personally because I'm excellent at fitting in.
Yeah, yeah. Like kind of a social tofu kind of person.
I've never heard that, but I love it.
Yeah.
Yes. No, totally social tofu. Like over here, I can be in your stir fry. Over here, I can be in your, you know, this. Yeah. I'm really good at assessing the situation and figuring out what do you talk about, what don't you talk about, what do you wear, how do you behave.
Well, let me reintroduce you. The person that just gave all these food metaphors during lunch hour is Brené Brown. She's a research professor at University of Houston Graduate College of Social Work, and she is a, as she just said, a qualitative researcher and studies vulnerability and worthiness. She's now exploring the concept of wholeheartedness. What is that, Brené? Wholeheartedness.
Well, it's interesting because after 6 years of studying specifically shame and fear and vulnerability, you know, what is driving? What drives our collective sense of never enough? You know, never good enough, rich enough, thin enough, beautiful enough, power enough, powerful enough. What drives that? After 6 years of studying that and kind of trying to get my head and heart around shame, I went back into the data asking a different question because along the way I had interviewed many people who were living in the same kind of scarcity culture that all of us are in today. But these were folks who were waking up in the morning and saying, you know what, I'm imperfect, I'm vulnerable, I don't know what's going on all the time, but I'm enough. And just because I'm vulnerable and imperfect doesn't mean that I'm not worthy of love and belonging. I'm absolutely worthy of love and belonging. So I wanted to know what those folks had in common. And so when I started doing the data analysis, I thought, what am I going to call these people? And the first word that came to my mind was wholehearted, that I was looking back in the data for men and women who were living and loving with their whole hearts, people who were all in. And so I define wholeheartedness as engaging with the world from a place of worthiness.
And as a clinician, I ask you, how was that done?
Well, it was interesting because if you took the folks who I've interviewed, who, again, like kind of the crude two-group analysis, if you took the folks who really struggled for a sense of love and belonging and compared them to people who felt a deep sense of love and belonging, not only did they have the capacity to love, but they believed, maybe even more importantly, that they were deeply lovable, the only thing that separated those two groups was the group that had the deep sense of love and belonging believed they were worthy of love and belonging. And this made me crazy when it came out in the research. And I mean, like, what does that mean, they believe they're worthy? You know, is there a moment where you say, you know what, I believe I'm worthy, and then you get the kind of, you know, you know, that kind of thing? That's what I was hoping for.
The commercial.
Right. I was hoping for the commercial. But as it turns out, these folks shared in common about 10 or 11 very specific a collection of choices that they made every day in their lives that were fundamentally different than the choices a lot of us make.
Well,
for example...
Before you give us example, I'm going to use those choices as a tease because we're going to hold them until after our break. We're going to take a 60-second break. I trust you that you will not forget those 10 choices because I want to hear them also.
You got it.
We're talking with Brené Brown. She's a research professor at University of Houston Graduate College, and she studies vulnerability, courage, worthiness, and wholeheartedness. Our number is 888-477-9499. We're talking about vulnerability. What makes you feel vulnerable, and what do you do about it? 888-477-9499. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family, right here on WHYY-FM.
Devereaux supports WHYY, a national behavioral healthcare organization founded and headquartered in Philadelphia. Devereaux is celebrating its 100th anniversary of providing innovative care for individuals with behavioral challenges, mental health illness, and developmental disabilities. Founded in 1912 by Philadelphia schoolteacher Helena Devereaux, the organization was developed to provide help to children and adults with special needs. Find more information about Devereaux and its centennial anniversary at 610-542-3041 or online at devereaux.org.
Christiana Care Health System's Center for Heart and Vascular Health supports WHYY. Studies show experience makes a difference in patient outcomes. Recognized by the Society of Thoracic Surgeons, Christiana Care cardiovascular surgeons perform more than 800 open heart procedures each year, and the team of heart specialists treats more than 8,000 total heart and vascular patients annually. Christiana Care, with locations in Pennsylvania and Delaware. More online at christianacare.org/heartleaders.
We're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb. We're talking about vulnerability, shame, and human connection, the whole issue of belonging, with Brené Brown. And I highly recommend you look her up in her TED Talks. They're just wonderful. Brené, you said that people who approach the world with an attitude that they are lovable, that they are worthy of being loved and they are loving, make choices every day. Like what?
So here's one for example. They choose rest and play, and they work very mindfully to let go of exhaustion as a status symbol and productivity as self-worth.
Whoever heard of that?
I have to tell you, like, completely honestly, and I talk about this in the TED Talk, when these choices, when this wholeheartedness data emerged, it sent me into a total tailspin, because I, you know, if there was, you know, there wasn't actually a to-do list and a not-to-do list, but if there was, I was living straight down the not-to-do list. So it was very difficult for me. I for about a year or two, I said I got hijacked by the data, and now I say that I got rescued by it, but it was tough, because choosing rest and play. I mean, I just recently wrote a blog post that talked about how I have such a fierce, lazy gremlin. You know, I've got a lot of triggers, shame triggers around resting. You know, like rest when you're dead, or, you know, you have to earn your rest, those kind of things. And so one of the things that these group of people did collectively, I mean, this saturated in the research as a very strong pattern, is these folks chose to play and chose to rest and really worked to let go of the cultural pressure to be exhausted and to hit your self-worth to how much you produce. Another example is that these folks, as a group, embraced creativity. And the thing that they had to work on letting go in order to embrace creativity was comparison. And, you know, for me, for example, you know, before this research, you know, if someone said, hey, do you want to go to a painting class with me, or do you want to go, you know, scrapbook or something, I'd chuckle. I'd say, you know, that's really cute that you have your ART, but I've got a J-O-B, so, you know, you go do your self-indulgence, yeah, like creativity, I'm going to work.
So who wins, and who wins in the long run? It's funny, I just did an interview with someone about research around dementias, which is supposed to triple over the next 30 years. But one of the things we're learning is that what contributes to later dementias is stress earlier in life.
And gosh, absolutely.
Let's go to the phones. We've got Susan on the line. Hi, Susan. You're on the air.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Sure.
Okay. I have always fought since I was a child with depression and fear, and I find that when I'm around anybody, even if I think they know me, I have to put on a face that everything's okay, because if I really try to be myself, they either don't want to be around me or they will call me names.
What is that self that you don't want to be?
Excuse me?
Tell me what that self would look like. The one.
Well, okay. If I am, let's say, I'm having a bad day today, and maybe I just feel tired or I'm sad, I then have to pretend to smile and pretend to laugh. But inside, I'm not feeling good. It's just the front.
Mm-hmm. Brene, what are your thoughts about Susan's position?
I feel like you very often, Susan, especially when I'm around my, you know, I've got young kids, and when I'm around my PTO friends and when I'm around other people in our neighborhood, it's a little bit of, how are you? Oh, I'm just great. How are you? But
fake it. You have to fake it.
Right. But what I have found to be true is that there are still people I sometimes feel the need to just say, I'm fine, thanks, and kind of move on. But there are also, what I've realized is that if we have one or two friends in our lives where we don't have to put on that mask, because it's suffocating, right? It just is. It's just overwhelming, and it's hot and sweaty, the mask is.
Yeah.
But if we have one or two people who we can just call in the morning before we face the day and say, you know what? I'm going to get through the day, but I just wanted to let you know that I'm kind of in the mood to, like, beat up some people, and I really just feel like staying under the covers with peanut butter. And that friend can come back to us with some empathy and say, oh, my God, I'll be over. I'll bring the peanut butter. I totally get it. That's enough for us to feel that genuine connection.
I would also add, Brene, and you know, we're going to hear about this later with Christian Neff, who talks about self-compassion. And even before you look elsewhere, and this happens with me often, you know, I've got my own history of depression, and you know, there's some mornings when I just wake up like a quart low with the serotonin.
Mm-hmm.
And when I suffer like that, I'm aware of my suffering, and I just feel great compassion for this kind person whose mind is just not right today. And that gives me a sense of kind of well-being and almost lovability, almost because I'm suffering.
And I find that I just wish, the only one I can really open up to is my therapist. And like your lady guest said, one good friend who is too far away from me, but we talk on the phone, and her encouragement does help.
Good, good. I am glad. Susan, I wish you the best.
You know, me too, Susan. And I can add, you know, I would like to add, I am a huge fan of Kristen Neff's work, and I quote it a lot in all of my work. And I do think the self-compassion, one of the rules that I'm trying to work on right now, and I'm not so great at it, maybe I'm just trying, it's new, is I'm trying to talk to myself like I would talk to a friend who I love. And I think so many of us talk to ourselves in ways that we would never talk to the people we care about. And so part of my self-compassion practice that was very much prompted by Kristen Neff's work is watching how I talk to myself.
Yeah, I mean, if we can find that self-compassion, that really does give us some underpinnings. And, you know, my God, that's portable. You know, we carry that
yeah.
with us. Let's see if we can get another phone call on. We've got Colleen on line 5. Hi, Colleen.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
So I was wondering, I have a mother who's recently dealt with a manic breakdown. And but she's not really willing to admit the extent of what happened. And I think it's the same kind of issue. She doesn't want to admit that she's vulnerable, but also that it's not her fault, you know, that it's, I don't know, not something wrong with her, but by not admitting this, she's not really able to get help for it. So I was just wondering if you have any advice for helping people to kind of open up about their vulnerability.
It's a great question, Brene. The shame and blame thing. Do you have any answer?
Yeah, I mean, it's really tough, and kind of mental health and physical health emerged as one of the big categories that we really feel shame about. And I think sometimes the best invitation that we can extend to someone to be vulnerable is to share our own vulnerabilities, to approach, you know, to approach your mom, or to approach, we have similar things, you know, happening, and have kind of, we have huge families, my husband and I do, and so there's usually some kind of something difficult going on, but to approach it from the perspective of me too, and I get it, and I get how scary it is to, how much we want to protect ourselves. I mean, when you were talking about this, your mom and her situation, I thought of Pema Chodron and her definition of compassion, that compassion is our ability to sit, our ability to know our own darkness well enough that we can sit in the dark with others, and that it's not a relationship between the wounded and the healed, but of equals. And so when I'm approaching someone in my family or someone I care about who's really struggling but absolutely afraid to be vulnerable and let their fear and their self-doubt bring that to the table, I normally start with a, here's how I think you're feeling and here's how I felt like that before, and I'm not perfect either and I'm struggling too, but together we can get some help.
I absolutely agree, and I've had that experience very often also, that when I am with someone in that position, more often than not, I talk about my vulnerability just right in that very moment, my sense of love and helplessness and confusion and sometimes desperation, and I just enter that moment very open and with my heart wide open, and that's difficult to do, and it's risky, but you know, it makes it very human between the two of you. So Colleen, I appreciate your call. Thank you. And I do wish you the best with your mom. And boy, talk about a sense of fear and helplessness, huh? What would it look like if we didn't avoid our own vulnerability, Renee?
I think this sounds very counterintuitive, but I would think we would be very brave people.
Go on. You're not going to get away with that.
Spoken like a true therapist. yes. I think that one of the reasons we don't try new things, we don't put ourselves out there, that one of the reasons we see crises in creativity and innovation is because we're afraid to risk, we're afraid to fail, we're afraid to look not smart or awkward. We're afraid to chime in a conversation that a group of neighbors is having about the presidential election because maybe we don't have all the facts. But in doing that and holding back because we feel too vulnerable to show up, to really show up and get in there and mix it up, not only do we lose out, but the people around us lose out because they don't get to hear what we think. And it doesn't matter if we have all the facts or we have a dangling modifier or we do something that fails. At least we've shown up. And
well,
we've tried.
Brene, we have to end. I think what you've done is wonderful, and I think you're delightful. So thanks so much for joining us. That's Brene Brown. She's a research professor at the University of Houston Graduate College. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voice in the Family here on WHYY-FM.
Plan of Pennsylvania supports WHYY, created by families for families. Plan of PA offers planning, trust, and care management services to adults with mental differences in the five-county Greater Philadelphia area. Plan of PA services are designed to help families address the care and support of their adult family member with special needs in response to the question, who will care for my loved one when I am no longer able? More information at planofpa.org or 610-687-4036.
Supporting WHYY, HEAL, Holistic Enrichment of Adult Living. HEAL offers health advocacy, companion caregiving, and consultative services to adults with acute and chronic medical conditions. HEAL develops a personalized plan of care for each client. HEAL then provides a quality assurance program to track satisfaction and closely monitor service and outcomes. Their goal is to holistically support an enriched, independent, and healthy lifestyle. Information about HEAL is available online at healconsultants.org.
We're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb. We're talking about vulnerabilities on today's show and how to address the shame attached to them. My next guest is Kristen Neff. She addresses all of this in her research and teaching. She's the author of Self-Compassion, which comes out in paperback this summer. She teaches human development and culture at the University of Texas in Austin, and her family, she and her family were featured in the award-winning documentary The Horse Boy, about her son's life with autism. I interviewed Kristen last week. I began by asking her about vulnerability in light of how the late CBS reporter Mike Wallace took a risk by speaking publicly about his depression. Kristen, what makes Mike Wallace and others who've spoken about their mental illness so special is that traditionally mental illness is so shameful. After all, you know, what's more frightening than losing control of one's mind? It seems we've always been afraid of our own minds, yes?
Yes, no, absolutely, and laboring under the illusion of control as well, so it's frightening when that illusion is shaken.
I wonder why, Kristen. Any idea why we're so afraid of our minds?
Well, first of all, minds create our reality, right? It's the window through which we perceive things, and I think naturally, as organisms, we want to be in control, and it's very scary when our minds aren't operating the way we want them to, because, again, it makes you realize that you aren't in the driver's seat all the time. And even though it's a truth, it's a really hard truth to face up to.
Boy, it sure is. That's probably the hardest, is facing up to the truth that we've got so little control.
Yeah.
It really is counterintuitive to open up what's shameful.
Yeah, it is. And it's not, I would say it's not a natural instinct, because we have a natural instinct as a live organism to move away from pain. But when you turn towards pain and embrace it, it actually isn't as hard as you might think. It just takes some practice. But
What's that look like?
Well, you know, I do, my life's work really is all about self-compassion. And from my point of view, it takes more than just accepting the emotion. It really takes embracing it with kindness. And when we give ourselves compassion and care, we're tapping into our own caregiving system, which makes us feel safe. And the whole reason we hide these supposed flaws is because, again, as you say, it frightens us. So when we can feel safe and held, then it allows us to, open up. And, you know, in some ways, it's funny. In my work, I've really learned that it's important for people to have compassion for their self-critic. Because at some level, the self-critic is trying to help you. It's just doing it in a very dysfunctional way. But it's trying to point out a problem that needs to be attended to, because there's some part of us that's scared about this problem. It might somehow harm us. And at a deep level, maybe it might kill us even.
I want to unpack that a little bit. This concept of embracing the self-critic sounds good, but what does it look like, feel like?
Well, again, a lot of it is just letting go of the judgment of the self-critic. And part of compassion is having understanding for why a particular behavior is there, and understanding that, you know, hundreds, maybe thousands of various causes and conditions had to come together for that behavior to exist. So having compassion for why it's there, both evolutionarily and also our society, our family upbringing, helps us to, you know, like I say, in a way, I teach this in my workshops on self-compassion, and for a lot of people, that's a huge revelation, and they even become friends with their self-critic, even though they don't take its message seriously. It's like a little child who tantrums. You know, you understand why the child's tantruming, but it's just that, you know, you don't want to take it too seriously, and you want to give it more skills so that they can resolve their unhappiness with better means. Marshall Rosenberg has a great quote, which is, self-criticism is the tragic expression of an unmet need.
Hmm. Right?
So it's trying to point out something is wrong. Pay attention, something is wrong. But it does it by fighting and attacking, which ironically just harms us more.
Part of what happens when we are vulnerable is that we need help. And that is so difficult for humans to turn to someone else and say, I'm vulnerable and I need help, which is odd to me considering the fact that we're social animals. So how do we say to ourselves and others that I'm vulnerable here, I'm fragile at the moment, please help me?
Yeah, well, you know, for one thing, I think you do have to be wise about who you open up to, because if you do make yourself vulnerable and you tell someone who is going to somehow take advantage of that or have a negative reaction, that's going to be really painful. I do think, however, that if you can accept yourself as an imperfect human being first, recognizing that the human condition is by definition vulnerable and imperfect, then when you do open up to people, you're doing it from a place of a little more balance, and I think other people pick up on that. So in other words, when you admit your vulnerability and you're very, very frightened, I think sometimes what happens is other people, it reminds them of their own vulnerability, and they'd rather blame you than admit that, wow, we don't have total control. So when you can really address that as much as possible with yourself, then I think when you go to other people, they don't feel as frightened because they're seeing you trying to cope with it.
Ideally, they see you being comfortable with your own vulnerability. I had a teacher in the early 70s who said to me, the world is full of people trying to be filet mignon, and deep down we know we're only meatballs.
Or pink slime nowadays.
Oh, God.
Yeah,
there was no pink slime in the 70s. But, you know, it's true. We hide from our own mediocrity, our own averageness.
Well, and the funny thing is being average isn't even necessarily being mediocre. You know, as human beings, we also have a lot of beautiful qualities that maybe aren't even that unusual. Being a good friend, being a good parent. So we really don't have to compare ourselves to others all the time. And I think that's the problem. I'm sure you've heard the research that people who come in second in some competition feel a lot worse than people who come in third, right? Because it's that bit of comparison that really makes us feel inadequate. There's an amazing sense of connectedness when you realize, wow, all humans are imperfect. All humans feel inadequate. You know, all humans suffer. There can be a lot of comfort in that.
Right? My guest is Kristen Neff. She's the author of Self-Compassion, which comes out in paperback this summer. She's an associate professor in human development and culture at the University of Texas in Austin. Kristen, I blog for the Christopher Reeve webpage, and as you can imagine, the word acceptance comes up a great deal, and that word is really like a lightning rod. Many people become angry at the word, and yet suffering is really about fighting against the truth of your life, isn't it?
There's a great equation, which is suffering equals pain times resistance. You know, so life inevitably has pain, but we add a lot of extra suffering by fighting the reality of life. And if you let go of the resistance, usually the pain isn't nearly as bad as the suffering was. Again, I think some people hate the word acceptance. They have to give up their illusion of control. And B, people think it's passive. And in a weird way, you give up the illusion of, you know, being in the driver's seat. But as you probably know, Carl Rogers said, the curious paradox is that when I accept myself, then I can change. because it kind of releases all the ways we're stuck. Resistance makes us stuck.
A lot of this is about the ego screaming, I don't deserve this, I'm better than this. I have had an experience last year. I had a fall out of my wheelchair, and I'm left with a great deal of neuropathic pain in my arms. And early on, you know, when I felt this pain, I would become frightened and angry and tell myself stories about what it meant for my future, and I couldn't live with it, and all sorts of things. It started with that personal pronoun. And then I learned the anatomy and physiology of this pain, that my nerves were overstimulated, overreactive, and all of a sudden, it shifted everything. And I realized that it was my arms that were suffering. And I felt compassion for my arms.
Wow.
And the pain didn't diminish. It still hurt like hell. But the storyline dropped. And like I had a bigger context for that pain. And it really did diminish the suffering.
Yeah.
I mean, I still feel pain, and that sucks. Nothing's going to change that. But the storyline went away.
Yeah, no, that's a beautiful story, right? Yeah. And, you know, and as you say with the ego, I think, again, the problem is because we confuse our self-concept or our thoughts about ourselves with the actual living, breathing experience. You know, I would argue that we're a verb, not a noun. And so when the ego gets frightened, it feels like our very life is under attack. And when you drop that, then it's workable.
I think often of my daughter's three-legged dog, Marley, three-legged pit bull. And like the leg came off, and Marley said, okay, what's for lunch? what's next, you know?
Yeah.
You said elsewhere, Kristen, that we shouldn't strive to need to be a better person. We should accept ourselves as we are. And, you know, almost every day, the issue I deal with in my office is, who am I really? I'll give you an example. A young man just yesterday said that he wishes he was more spontaneous. And he said he's not because he feels anxious and inhibited. He was telling me that he really was a spontaneous person who needed help becoming one. So the question is, you know, who am I really? Am I a shy person that I need to accept that? Or am I a spontaneous person?
Or both,
yeah, exactly.
Depending on the day. You know, I think when we try to label ourselves as one thing or the other, we also aren't capturing the reality, which is we're multiple things. And who we are depends partly on who we're around, what's the social context. Again, when you fully accept yourself as you are, then nature can take its course. I think authenticity naturally comes out when you aren't trying to manage the show so much.
When you talk about self-acceptance, it's important that we know that that's not about self-indulgence. It's not about not trying to make yourself better. What is it?
Right. And this point is, it's such a razor's edge that it can be very confusing for people. So, you know, the important thing, and the reason I use self-compassion more than self-acceptance, is because compassion actually is active. So compassion is bringing a sense of kind, care, soothing, desire for well-being toward whoever we are that we're accepting. Okay, and that's the part that's really active. And the compassion, just like a compassionate mother, totally accepts and loves her child as they are, flaws and all, at the same time that she's naturally going to do everything she can to help her child not suffer and to reach his or her full potential. And I think that's what self-compassion does for us. With full acceptance, we try to help ourselves not suffer. And that's the reason it's not self-indulgence, because what's the difference between self-indulgence and self-compassion? Self-indulgence feels good in the short term, but harms us in the long run. And self-compassion doesn't want us to suffer in the long run.
I'm speaking with Kristen Neff, the author of Self-Compassion. She's an associate professor in human development and culture at the University of Texas in Austin. She and her family were featured in the award-winning documentary and best-selling book, The Horse Boy, about her son's life with autism. Tell us about some of your exercises on your webpage. And by the way, your webpage is just terrific and accessible. So
yeah, I did really try to make it as accessible as possible. Probably one of my favorite exercises is that when you're upset or feeling a lot of pain or feeling a lot of self-judgment, the simple act of putting your hand or both hands gently and kindly over your heart is amazingly powerful. And that's because, again, as mammals, our bodies are really designed to respond to warmth and soothing touch. So even if your mind can't go there and it's full of the storyline, if you access some of the fear and pain in your body through that gentle, caring touch, it can actually reduce your cortisol levels, you know, and tap into the system that is associated with opiates and oxytocin and help you feel stable even before your mind can go there. So that's a very easy one. Another one, actually, the one I probably get the most comments on, is I had a little guided meditation, and it's in some ways it's more of an exercise than a meditation, that's called Soften, Soothe, and Allow. And again, what it does is it helps you soothe and work with your emotions in your body. So it involves, you know, focusing on whatever is upsetting you, whether it's an inadequacy or, you know, your boyfriend left you or something like that. And first labeling the emotion, and labeling the emotion actually helps create that little bit of distance. So instead of being lost in anger, you can say, anger, that's anger, right? And then, very important, you find it in your body. You feel it. You know, feelings are felt in the body. So again, moving away from the storyline of, let's say, the anger, finding it in your body. Where is it in your body? Where are you holding it? So softening physically around where the actual feeling is in your body. And you do that kind of mentally by just trying to relax. And often it's helpful to go to the edges of the feeling first because they aren't quite as intense. And then you soothe. You know, it sounds funny, but I use terms of endearment with myself because you know, I respond to that. So, oh, poor darling. Oh, that feels, that's so hard. That's so hard to bear right now. And I might even put my hand gently over the spot. And then once you've soothed yourself, then you can allow it to be there. You know, this really hurts, but that's the reality. And in a way, you know, it's okay. It's okay.
That's really how we get into most difficulty, most trouble, is when we can't tolerate our own emotions and we act on them. And, you know, if we can just learn to tolerate whatever emotion we're feeling right now, they generally go away on their own.
Yeah. They say most emotions have a life of about 20 minutes. I mean, it really depends on how strong the emotion is. But if you were just to totally accept it, it would probably pass on its own in 20 minutes. But if you keep feeding the emotion with the storyline or with resistance, it can last quite a bit longer.
Kristen, I first met you when I watch the movie you and your husband made called The Horse Boy, about your family trying to help your son who has autism. You were visiting shamans in Mongolia, and I was really impressed that you and your husband just did whatever you could do for your son. One of the things I was struck about with that movie was you were very open and vulnerable there, and You know, we talked about that earlier, about my being so open with my vulnerability. What was that like for you, being that exposed that publicly?
Yeah, well, you know, I'll admit it was uncomfortable. One thing that really helped is it was a very small crew, three people, and they were all our friends. And also, we produced it ourselves. So I knew the bottom line was, if there was anything I really didn't want to be made public, I could have some veto power. But I think I'd had a very long-term self-compassion practice at that point, and I just didn't feel bothered by not presenting a perfect picture to the world or a perfect picture of our life, because, you know, this is a human experience. And I suppose I wasn't, rightly or wrongly, I wasn't that worried about the judgment of others. And I really knew that by showing that autism can be an adventure, and that when you turn towards something that's so difficult and really embrace it, more than just tolerate, actually embrace it and say, where can this lead me? You know, what new things can this open up to me? In my book as well, you know, I'm just really honest, because I didn't want people to think that I was this perfect person, right, telling them how they should live their life. I am just as flawed, and I've made as many serious mistakes as anyone. But it's okay, because it's human, and I can embrace that, and I've learned so much from my mistakes and my painful experiences than I've had from the ones that are happy and that I wanted.
Kristen, well, I have to say, from the bottom of my heart, I wish you great happiness and well-being.
Oh, thank you, and you too.
That was Kristen Neff. She's the author of Self-Compassion, which comes out in paperback this summer. She teaches human development and culture at the University of Texas in Austin. Go to WHYY/voices to link to her website, where you can find out more about the exercises she spoke about in my interview. And next week on Voices in the Family, bedside manner, its importance, and the training that's now available to health professionals. Well, you can reach me at drdangottlieb.com or our production team at voices@whyy.org. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Al Banks. Elizabeth Perez Luna is our executive producer of audio content. Emily Haas is our volunteer. Mark Cernero is our intern. Mike and Scott is our executive producer. Jennifer Lynn produces this show. Me, I'm Dan Gottlieb. Enjoy your week, my friend.